So the subject for the evening talk is the powers of mind. Last September, my uncle, who was about 75, 76 years of age, died, and my mother, that is his sister, just two or three weeks before, had decided, at the age of 78, to emigrate to Australia. Not because of her son, I might add. And she went to live nearby where my sister lives. And my uncle's wife, when she told me of the death of her husband, so that night at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I took the car journey, my daughter and I, to Cornwall, which is the next county, and it was about a 4 or 5 hour drive so that we could be there early in the morning for the funeral, which was about 10 o'clock that morning. The following day, I also had a early departure from home because I was flying to Holland, to Amsterdam, where I had never been before. And the flight was from an airport 2.5 hours away, Bristol Airport. So again, I left at about 3 o'clock in the morning to drive up through the night, through the dawn, to take this early morning flight. And in my car, I was playing a CD of a young Italian opera singer, Andrea Bocelli, who's blind, who's 28 years old, and some of us, and I'm certainly one, think he has just the most heartfelt, sweetest voice to listen to. And so some of us have become converts. And there's particularly one, my favorite piece of all, Conte Partiro, which is on the first song of one CD of his called Romananza. So when I got to Amsterdam Airport, it was probably about 10 o'clock, I think, in the morning, a friend from Amsterdam University came to pick me up at the airport. And I was due to speak in the early afternoon to the ecology department at the university there. And he said to me, "Christopher, we have a couple of hours to spare. Is there anything that you would like to do in the city before going to the university?" And I had with me, which I brought intentionally, a book which I've referred to here and in fact quoted from some 3 or 4 years ago, and this is the diaries of Etty Hillesum. And I said to my friend from the university, "There's just one thing that I want you to do. Just drive me to this address where she lived from 1941 to 43, which was in the introduction to the book. And he had heard of her, but only of the name. And we drove to the central south part of the city to this terraced house in that part of the city. And just outside the door was a small plaque acknowledging as a reference point that she had lived here before she went to Westerbork and to the concentration camp. And just And so then my friend, I asked my friend, just leave me, I'll just stay here. And then he went off, and I just wanted to walk around the streets. I'd read so much of her writings several times and have told many, many people about her writings over the years. And I went to sit in a small coffee shop just within eyesight of her home. And right opposite the house, there is a park, and during the war years, the fascist army, of course, did their military training in the park, and so every morning she would look out of the window and see this going on. And it meant a lot to me, because the street names, which I got familiar through reading in the book, were now actually I could actually feel and sense for. As I sat in the coffee shop, I got to the coffee shop, there was a school, and just 200 or 300 yards down the road from her home, and the children were pouring out of the school, and it was one of those typical inner city schools, and there were children from every nationality and every colour, and their mothers and fathers waiting outside, and the children were rushing out there. And I had a real beat in the heart, and the thought that came to my mind that watching those young children from Asia, from Indonesia, of course, from Africa, from Central America, from Europe, pouring out, and the thought arose in my mind, my goodness, that is the triumph over fascism, right there in all those little kids' faces. So I just sat in this coffee shop, eating my croissant, having a cappuccino. My friend had gone off making his phone calls and doing a couple of other things, and it was a typical European day, pouring with rain and people rushing by, etc., etc. And as I just sat there and just watched this world, and a little reflection of some of Etty's writings, out of the loudspeaker in the coffee shop came Conte Patero. I just, my tears just rolled out. I just, too much. And then, whatever it was, it was played, and then it was switched off. Nothing else went on. And I just sat there, having listened to this at 3 o'clock in the morning, driving up to Bristol, my favourite piece. It always touches me every time I listen to it. And then just sitting in that coffee shop in Amsterdam on a typical wet September day, and just watching the children and looking over to the house. And sometimes there's some kind of events, gosh, I don't know what to call it here, events, happenings, coincidences, meetings, and it just seems right in that moment a kind of authentic feeling and sense that one gets sometimes in life, and that's one of those incidences where one feels one was in exactly the right place, in exactly the right moment, and some kind of way it got confirmed through listening to this. And I use it as a small example, and although some friends in the Jewish community think Etty have read her, and one of them said, I remember when Stephen and I were in Jerusalem, one of them said very, very strongly, Etty, oh, she was totally out of touch with reality. But some of us have a feeling, actually, in a rather unusual way, she was very much in touch with it, but in an unusual way. But in mentioning, sometimes there's something that goes on in the inner life. It meets and it connects and coincides with something outside. And one feels something profound and inexplicable and mystical, and which we can't really fathom out how all of those things, one small event, just comes together and meets together. And there are these receptivities that go on in life, and in a way those kind of events, and I'm sure we could reflect and bring to mind some in our own life, I think there's a kind of natural humility which comes out of it. as I was saying the other evening, some things of life, you and I, we can't organise, we can't arrange. We wouldn't even think of the meeting point that takes place. And yet, nevertheless, we know it's an important aspect. And one of the English poets, G.K. Chesterton, a lovely writer, he said, he described these moments of life as, I hope you understand the latter word, tremendous trifles. Can you translate trifles? Anybody into Hebrew? Tremendous trifles. Kind of totally unimportant, yet tremendous. It's that kind of feeling. Totally unimportant, but tremendous. And hopefully our life is touched with tremendously unimportant things. And that sometimes in trying to arrange and organize our lives, sometimes we miss it. We're too preoccupied with ourselves or too preoccupied with other things, and we miss those wonderful meeting points. I'd say, well, what's that got to do with the powers of mind? Well, I'm not sure myself, but anyway, mostly I just want to relate the story, and then I'll come to the powers of mind. Sometimes in our looking and our attending to our inner life, one could get the impression, and particularly for those of you who are relatively new to these things, that after 4 or 5 days, it could seem like we are just focusing strictly and rather narrowly on one or two features, basically being mindful here and now. And sometimes, rather unfortunately, people participating in a retreat and then leaving afterwards, and some of you, I know you mentioned in the small group today, go home and some thoughts arise inside. Well, what am I going to say if anybody, it's unlikely, but if anybody asks me about what I was doing in the Negev for 5 days in July? And so sometimes in our relationship, we easily enough, and Catherine referred to this yesterday evening, want to define something in a particular way. And so we might say, oh, being here and now, or being mindful, or whatever. And it hardly sounds for the listener like the thrill of a lifetime. And we may forget that in the general body of the practices and the body of the approaches which is taking place, though one thing may be mentioned to us, that in fact it's related very directly with other features, and it forms together to really bring out of the human being the best in us. And the teachings, the Buddha in this case, referred to what he called the 5 powers of mind. And sometimes we're very much impressed by powers outside of ourselves, you know, and we might think in political terms or social economic terms or whatever. And sometimes we're not very impressed with powers outside of ourselves at all. And certainly one of the one-liners doing the rounds in political circles in other parts of the West is that what's his name, the leader of the Russians, Mr. Yeltsin, yeah, that Russia is ruled by an alcoholic, that the United States is ruled by a sex maniac, and in Britain we've got Jesus Christ. And if you lived in Britain, you know what I mean. So sometimes we look and we're impressed with these outer powers which are going on. And so much conversation, talk, reference point to our support and our protests, our approvals and our disapprovals. But sometimes, in all the energy that goes to the outer, it might be neglecting for us some of the inner life and the inner powers of being that we have, and the way that that genuinely can be nourished and developed and cultivated. And it has its own practices to it, of course, and its own own discipline. And those five powers of mind, one is trust. Trust. Another power of mind, of course, is mindfulness. To really have the capacity to give attention to daily life, to what is happening, to see very in a very focused and clear way. The third power of mind is samadhi. And that samadhi, it's hard to translate into English, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, but it means a depth of calmness and stability in the face of situations, and the ability to go deeper into ourselves. And the capacity for that is due to the samadhi. So the mindfulness practice, when it's accompanied with a certain concentration, a certain focus, a commitment, it develops a power in the mind, and that a power of the mind enables us and contributes to looking deeply. And sometimes the sense of that looking deeply, of course, is sometimes we experience it in the absence of a lot of thinking. And we feel grounded, and thought life seems to bubble, arise and pass, but there is a sense for something which is not just of conceptualizing. This is called samadhi. And the fourth area, also referred to a little bit in the inquiry today, is that inner energy and the importance of that. That the Pali word is viraya. Nearest in English is vitality. It's an energy for things, an energy for life. And when we put together that trust and faith, we put together mindfulness and the samadhi, we put together the energy for that, and of course wisdom as its support, this generates for us genuinely power of mind. And so sometimes when we're feeling overworked, overstressed, when we're feeling exhausted, when we're feeling limited in various ways, it may be necessary, and it is necessary, that we stop back and we say, well, in the five powers of mind, which one needs working on? Which one needs attending to? And is it faith and trust? Is it mindfulness? Being conscious, second. Is it samadhi, depth of presence? Is it fourth, is it energy? Fifth, is there something that I really need to understand, and that serves a real power of mind? And if we step back and you and I take a look, the possibility is that if there's difficult times, that one of those five is outstanding for us, does deserve our attention, and we can practice and we can cultivate each of those. And correspondingly, one notices that one feels actually somewhat less impressed with the powers outside. One feels more authority in our inner life, with love and care, of course, to be able to act, to be able to respond. And sometimes when there's a feeling of lacking of power of mind, one of the common expressions and demonstrations of it is a feeling of helplessness. What can you do? What can we do? And that feeling, we think, is a statement and the true reflection of reality. It's a reflection of the lack of power of mind. It's a reflection of the lack of stability and clarity running through the heart. So sometimes we experience, say, some doubt, some uncertainty, some inability too, and we either assume it's because, well, what can you do, meaning the situation is hopeless around us, whatever it might be, or we feel that, well, this is how I am, as though that's the finality, and therefore nothing can be cultivated and nothing can be developed, and we can't come into a greater power of mind to respond to situations. And so each one of them genuinely does count. And for some, of course, the order of them matters as well. How is our faith? What do we have faith in our daily life? What is worth having faith in? In what way in my daily life do I show my faith? Do I show my trust? What is actually helping to energize that? You know, as we, this evening, I do apologize for missing the service in the evening for the eve of Shabbat tomorrow, and community of people come together, and actually we've started this as well in Bodh Gaya, first time this year as well, and Jewish friends, and of course from Israel and elsewhere, said, "Oh, Christopher, why not do it in Bodh Gaya?" Well, why not? Buddhists there, Hindus there, Christians there, plenty of secularists. Why not the Jewish community? I mean, after all, you're everywhere else in India. So, 85,000 from Israel went to India last year, and I hope to see the rest of you next year. And so sometimes from acts of communion, acts of worship, acts of contact, acts of connection there, it gives support, it gives energy, it renews commitment. And those things matter. We give support to each other, and everybody gives support to themselves. And those kind of meetings and events are a real contribution to heart and mind. Real contribution to using situations which help us to stay steady in difficult circumstances. And sometimes we are far too reliant on just thinking, trying to think our way through things, trying to answer all problems through ideas. And therefore we say, yes, there are other resources. It includes those, but it includes others. Point is, am I as a human being using them? Where do I see the need and the necessity to develop powers of mind? What way in my life? And so sometimes here over the days, I think every day I will have had conversations, as well Catherine and Stephen as well, of course, with you. And sometimes we have looked at something and we have said, this, whatever it is, needs to change. It could be tendency or a pattern of mind or something unsatisfactory or a way of communicating or something. And we could spend a tremendous amount of time thinking that it needs to change. That doesn't mean to say, of course, that the thinking will carry the power of mind for the initiative to take place. And so sometimes we need to step back and say, well, where would the power of mind come from? What will nourish it? What will help to make it happen? And sometimes one not only needs the power of mind for the action, but the power of mind to stay steady with the result, with the feeling afterwards. Take a situation there. We know we need to say something to somebody. And it does need to be communicated. We plenty of examples, I'm sure, in most of our lives here. And one is hesitant, terribly hesitant. And the hesitancy is maybe, can I say what I want to say clearly? The second hesitancy is, what is he or she going to say when I say this? So then we spend rather a long time here. going through imaginary conversations. When I say this, she'll say that, and then I'll say this, and she'll say that, and I'll say this, and then I'll win. And this inner dialogue that goes on with what I'll say and what he or she will say, it goes backwards and forwards. Sometimes it's so tiring that come the end of the retreat, we haven't got any energy left, therefore the lack of the fourth power of mind, to actually say anything. We've completely used it up in our internal dialogues. So, I hope that's not too bad news for some of you. So sometimes we know something has to be said. If it is said, it takes a power of mind to say it. But as I mentioned, sometimes it's so difficult that after having said it, one can feel terrible inside. Awful feeling, feel bad, feel guilty, feel it was a mistake, feel that one was misunderstood, feel that one should never have said anything anyway, that it was a dreadful idea in the first place, that one's completely blown the relationship with this person, or whatever it might be. So sometimes we do speak up, we do speak out, we express the power of mind, but it requires, to repeat, a power of mind to stay steady with how we feel after the event. Or to stay steady with how the other person feels after the event. And sometimes we say things and then we're rapidly regretting what we say, and then we're rushing over to the person, prostrating 3,000 times with profuse apologies, and the person says, "Too late. You're too late. I never want to see you alive again." And so when one has to deal not only with what expressed, what returns, and finding the power of mind to stay steady, and sometimes all that we can rely upon is that somewhere in it the intention that we had, even though the first power of mind might get affected. Loss of trust, loss of faith, and doubt setting in. So all four, five of them really do interact together. And I know as a Dharma teacher, every day we listen to difficult and painful circumstances of people. Some of them are lighter, of course, some of them are more moderate, and some of them are very, very intense circumstances of people's lives. And sometimes people have arrived and have felt and are in a terrible despair. And sometimes a person has said, "You know, Christopher, I'm feeling absolutely feel terrible despair and terribly depressed, and I can't face going on living anymore, and I just want to kill myself, I just want to commit suicide, I can't take it anymore." And it's a reflection of many, many factors. And then one is giving the evening talk, and this has happened when I mention it, and then that person who an hour or two before has been saying they feel very suicidal, they can't go on with this anymore, and then the person gets up and walks out of the meditation hall. You have no idea what they're going to do. And does one stop the talk, and does one have trust or faith that it will be okay? Does one turn to someone that one knows who has lots of kindness and just ask that person just to go and check on that person, etc.? So there are some, and any of those responses, of course, might be completely appropriate. So there are situations in our life where there is difficulty and intensity which is taking place, and whatever the outcome, and I'm saying this, whatever the outcome, one sometimes has to have the trust and faith that the heart was in the right place. Even if that person, something terrible happened, and the person killed themselves. You know, I had last A friend of mine, many years from India, 18 years I've known him, and hadn't seen him for some time, and has had a long, painful history with drug addiction, and struggled with it, and terrible pain. And he always was saying, and very few believed him, that the pressure that he was feeling in the pressure he was feeling in his head, and that only the heroin was giving him relief from it, hence the addiction and all that painful world, underworld, that goes with such heavy drugs. He was in such a bad state at one time, he wanted to kill himself. He said he couldn't do it, and what he did was he telephoned the police, and he sat in the bed in a cheap hotel room in Los Angeles, and he had a plastic gun in his hand, and he called the police and he said, if you're not here in 5 minutes, I'm either going to shoot myself or shoot the first person that comes through the door. And the police were around there like a rocket. And he had the gun, like this plastic gun, because he wanted the policeman to knock the door down and shoot him dead on the spot. And as soon as the policeman rushed in, he pulled it there, and the policeman came with a gun and fired, and nothing happened. And the reason that nothing happened, because the police officer had remembered first thing in the morning that you have one empty chamber, so you don't fire in reaction and then find yourself being sued for murder or manslaughter or something. And he left one chamber, he told me he left one chamber, and he pulled it, and of course just the click, and in that very moment out of the plastic gun came the water. The policeman pissed himself. The urine went straight down his clothes. He was such a shock to the system. So sometimes in our contact, in our connection, and very wonderfully, people in the Sangha have been taking care of this and giving support to this person over the last year. So sometimes there are situations in life where there's dramas and stories which are going on in people's lives, which sometimes we hardly have any access to, hardly have any contact with. And to be able to stay steady in those kind of situations in life, again comes back, as Buddha put it so significantly, to human being must have those powers of mind. We need those powers of mind to be a support for ourselves and for others. And therefore, it genuinely is worth reflection and attention to, and see how they are in the quality of our life. It is difficult, obviously it is difficult in a situation like this to see the relationship between here and there. And tomorrow morning, Steve and us will speak more to you about this. But there's that process of reflection which goes on, looking into and seeing, what can I cultivate? What can I develop? What would be the ways and means to make and help that happen? So that real ideas and sensitivities and visions and abilities in life to relieve suffering, to transform circumstances, actually come because we find the ways and means in our inner life to make something outwardly possible. And it's not at all unusual, of course, in all of that sometimes we can't see, as I mentioned earlier, what the relationship to the process of meditation and the inner work to the outer. We don't know how it will manifest. those sort of things meeting together, and I can say the same in monastic life, no concept, no clue, no vision, nothing which would say, oh, I'm doing this for this. But I just had, fortunately, just enough trust that the process itself of sitting, walking, standing, being in the silence, which I regard as my university, having been blessed enough to miss the other kind, that university of the inner life had no idea where it would go. How could one? But time and space and movement and life and energy, etc., and it finds its appropriate place, as many other people and friends do. Yeah. At the outer level, sometimes with power, I'm not going to name the person, but it'd be nothing short of a miracle if you don't know who I'm talking about. And that is, you may hear here, and of course in India as well, there's this word of miracles and all these things. And there's a kind of long, unfortunate history in spiritual life and religious practices with regard to all of this. And so one has this chap down in South India, and producing vibhuti and Seiko watches and gold rings, and there are very strong people who believe very, very strongly, I can't swallow it, but of something coming from absolutely nothing, that there's nothing there at all, and it's boop, and out vibhuti is sacred ash. And or rings. And I notice when I speak of these things in the same way in India, some people get very terribly, you might as well if you wish, terribly irritated with me for daring to question the whole idea of miracles. And I was several years ago, this popular, probably the world's most popular guru, million, they fly in jumbo jet, they fly in all over the world to see this. And one person, one of the devotees, who's been with him for several years, said to me, when he is producing vibhuti, that means the sacred ash, and spraying it on people, etc., etc., that it is coming out of his photographs in people's homes in the West and other parts of the world at the same time. Well, my first word was nonsense. But so I said, you know, are you quite sure? Oh yes. Many devotees, they see it comes out of his eyes and out of his nose and out of his mouth and the photographs on the wall. So I said, look, it goes totally against everything I've ever understood about dependent arising conditions. And if this is the reality, here is my fax number, here is my home address, here is my email, here is my website, here is Gaia House, just tell me, and I promise I'll be on the first plane, I don't mind anywhere in the world, and I will go there, and if you just let me do this first. And if it comes out, the ash, I will be on a super rocket straight to Bangalore, bowing non-stop till I'm dead. So I gave her all the information there. Obviously, I haven't heard anything. Yeah. And then in India, those of you who know appreciate this, in India, somebody made a secret video of this miracle worker, this great powerful guru who produces all these miracles, tangible miracles, produced a video. And the video secretly got circulated all around the ashrams in India. For one reason only. With the video, you can slow down the speed frame by frame. Oh no! It's not a miracle after all. It's a party trick. That's what it is. It's a party trick. Maybe the outcome of the party trick is some schools and some clinics and some hospitals and help for the poor and some nice projects in the region, and that's wonderful to see. But it's a party trick. It's not a miracle. It's not a great power. It's sleight of hand. And sometimes we look out there as extreme example, but we look out there and in some way or other, in looking out there and in elevating such persons into superhuman status, I believe we devalue ourselves. I believe it's deep down, it's a lack of respect for our own being. And we compensate for that lack of respect of our own being by elevating others into these metaphysical statuses. And there's something seriously amiss with that way of living. And it creates the gaps between human beings. It creates gaps which undermine us. And therefore, say, in reducing those kind of gaps, in the attendance and in looking into ourselves and connecting with each other and being as true and as authentic as we can, to me that matters much more. And therefore, faith and trust matter. Awareness, mindfulness, second one, matters. A depth of samadhi, deep inner life, matters there. Energy for life and sustaining that matters a great deal, and wisdom matters. And if we put our care and attention for that, and we repay and acknowledge others who express that and use those powers of mind well and skillfully and compassionately in this world, then we're paying respect to all, and we're just singularly unimpressed with these so-called powerful people. It actually lies with us and in our hearts and our hands and in our awareness, and it's people like ourselves that really can make the difference for a genuinely compassionate and a genuinely liberated life. We can do it. And I much prefer that the Sangha and men and women put their care and attention into that and give support to others who are doing the same thing. And that power transforms. That power makes the difference. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings be in touch with inner and outer life. May all beings live with liberation and with love. So let's have 2 or 3 minutes quiet period together. It's just a more addition of a friend struggling with his heroin addiction. After that, he went to the hospital, taken to the hospital, and they found in the front part of the brain a large tumor, and the tumor had been causing all this pressure over the years. And when they operated, they used this kind of keyhole surgery, the pus from the tumor came out and hit the wall of the operating theater, and the surgeon said the pressure in that was 32 pounds per square inch in that tumor. That's a bicycle tire, which is hard. That had been there for years. And all the difficulties and the rejections, etc., etc., about his addiction, in this case, was related to this tumor. He's still struggling with it, still very, very difficult. In the retreat, as a result of all of this, he is 90% blind, and in the retreat, one person for a walking period, he did his walking period with one person walking in front and his hands on the shoulders of that person. Still struggling with this. So sometimes I say inner life to outer life, and the ways that we can give support and reach out to others.